This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 8 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's the first Friday of the month, the day we talk about dogs here on the Afternoon Magazine. Dog care, behavior, and training. With us this month, dog trainers Jim Keel and Robin Haggard. They're with the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana, and this is a topic we take up once a month. So if you've got a question about dogs, give us a call, or a dog in particular, give us a call and talk to Robin and Jim. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to talk with us, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And then we have a toll-free number, which is good wherever you're listening, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And we hope to hear from you this afternoon if you're curious about dogs. Well, good to see you, Robin. It's been a while.
Thank you.
And yep. Jim?
Hello.
Welcome back. How are you?
It's October.
Yeah. And it's nice and cool. So you two and the Malamutes must be feeling
around.
Pretty comfortable. Right. Jim and Robin have Malamutes out at a place they call Poker Flats. So how is everybody out there?
We're having problems with Doris, who just recently discovered that she can jump up on the counter and take stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, she's gotten rather good at it. She's 9 years old, but
she just figured out this trick.
Well, she's been counter surfing, you know, here and there.
I think Ross taught her. He said, look, you can jump up and you can reach stuff.
But last night she reached new heights, and she got on top of the stove, and she got several loaves of bread.
Whoa.
And just had a high old time. So,
yeah, so now the bread has to go into a cupboard. Or,
yeah.
And then Ross can figure out how to do that and teach
Doris.
If only
we could train her not to do it.
Yeah. So we're taking the high road. She's in a crate today.
Okay.
Jump on the Danville thing before the flood of calls.
Oh, yes. In Danville tomorrow at Ellsworth Park, there's going to be a dog day in the park. I'm not sure what time it starts. I would say 9 to 10 o'clock. They're going to have some demonstrations of some dog sports like agility and rally obedience, and also police dog demonstrations, and they'll have some booths. I'm not sure about face painting for kids, but a raffle and just some things for people to do. So it should be fun. It's nice weather. It's free. So enjoy yourselves out at Ellsworth Park in Danville tomorrow.
Bring the family.
Yeah.
And I think we've got a listener calling in now to talk with the two of you. So we'll go to that caller. Put your headphones on there so we can hear them. Line one, Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. We're kind of new to this whole dog thing. We just got one from the pound 2 weeks ago. They recommend crate training, and she's okay going in a crate, but my son wants to know how long we're supposed to, like, let her stay in the crate. She's in it during the day while we're gone, and we have had her in at night. She doesn't seem to have any accidents. She chews on some things, but nothing that she's not supposed to chew on.
How old is she?
They said she was 1 year, 8 months when we picked her up.
It depends. If you're away for like 8 or 9 hours during the day for work and that sort of thing, once she gets used to the crate and she's comfortable with it, you could leave her for that length of time, although make sure that she's well exercised before she goes in the crate in the morning and make sure she has water while she's in the crate.
Yeah, we do that, and she's been in there the whole time as it is. She was in the kennel at the pound.
Right.
So we figured she was used to it, but he kind of feels guilty.
Tell him not to. Dogs are cave dwellers, and actually, I've got a
den dwellers.
Den dwellers, cave dwellers. We have an open crate in our living room, and I have a 11-year-old male that breaks into the living room so he can go lay in the crate.
Okay.
So, they like to be in their kind of den-like place, and And so
you can experiment with longer times in the crate over the weekend, you know, and if the dog gets distressed, then you're right there. You're not gone. We are, I talk for a living. sometimes when we're on the road with the dogs and they're in crates in the van, sometimes they'll be in the crate for maybe 10 hours without getting out to exercise. You know, unless somebody starts to say, hey, I got to get out, then we stop and let them out. But most of the time they're just sleeping. If we're traveling during the day, you know, they sleep during the day anyway, so.
Oh, okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Robin, you were going to say something else?
I was just going to say, now that I'm retired and I'm home all day, I have a bigger appreciation of how much they sleep. After he goes to work in the morning and lets the house dogs out, you know, nobody says a word until, 5:30 in the afternoon unless I go wake them up. I had a guy come out to tow some old vehicles a couple weeks ago, and he noticed the kennel sign on one of the old trucks, and he said, oh, do you still have dogs? And he'd been there for an hour and a half, and he had not heard one dog.
Oh.
They didn't even wake up.
Yeah.
So they just, you know, if they're exercised in the morning, they go to sleep and you go to work, and for the older dogs in particular, they just as soon stay asleep until you get home.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my mom had a dog, and the dog actually, when it felt a little insecure, it headed right for the crate.
They like their crates. And
it's like a den.
Yeah.
And if you don't use it as a punishment, it's always positive. You give them treats when they go in it. To get dogs used to crates, I feed them in the crate, even with the door open. Just put their dog food dish in the crate for them to eat. And pretty soon they regard that as their place. Make sure they have, you know, toys, treats. I usually like to give them a bone or something if it's a young dog and I know that they're, you know, not as comfortable staying in it for a long time. I give them something to chew on.
How much room should there be in there for them to turn around and about that big of a size and some headroom and...
As long as they can comfortably turn around, I like the crate to be so that they can stretch their legs out sideways, so if they want to sleep sideways. Ours often sleep on their backs with their legs straight up in the air, leaning against the side of the crate for balance.
Support.
So, you know, but they, you know, they like to have their bellies exposed because it's cooler for them, I'm sure, but... you don't want it to be too big because then the dog might feel like they could use it as a potty, but most dogs will not soil where they live. So unless they've been raised in a situation where they couldn't get away from it, they will not go where they live. We have kennel runs for our dogs, and they typically don't like to go in their runs. If they know when they're going to be let out, they'll wait, and they don't even go in their dog run. And if I have one that goes in their run and I put them with a dog that doesn't, within a couple of days, they're not going in that run. It's like their buddy said, we don't go here. You know, it's not allowed.
It's frowned on.
Yeah. So,
this is the Afternoon Magazine. Dog trainers Robin Haggard and Jim Keel are with us this afternoon. This is a topic we take up once a month on the first Friday of the month. Robin and Jim are with the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana, and they're happy to take your questions this afternoon. If you've got a question about a dog or dogs in general, give us a call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. And we've got a call coming in, so rather than make that person wait, and I won't launch into another topic, let's go and take that call now. Listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question. Sometime in the news a while back, I don't know, a month or two, there was a puppy mill, I guess, or I'm not sure if that's the right term, where they were raising a lot of different dogs in some county in central Illinois, where they confiscated, I think, like 50 dogs or something. And it was an Amish situation, and the commentator on the news said something about that they were just raising them as livestock. And anyway, I wondered if, since I gather one of you at least raises some dogs, and I wondered what the state requirements are for a kennel. Do you have to have so many dogs, and then what, do they inspect it, or do, you know, do they have to have so much space for each dog, or what's, you, could you comment on that?
I don't know all of the state law, but I do know you have to have at least five or more breedable females, intact females. Years ago when we had probably more intact girls than we got now, since we only have a couple now, we were inspected by the state a few times, and they just come out and kind of generally look to make sure the dogs have water, that they have adequate room. I don't think the state says that the kennel runs have to be a certain size, although they may have a minimum that I'm just not aware of. And they just kind of generally check the conditions to make sure that the dogs look like they're, you know, well cared for. Since we don't breed very many litters and we don't have that many intact girls, we haven't been inspected now in a long time. But the place in near Arthur, I think it was, had the conditions weren't awful, but they were not, I think, as good as they could have been. And so there was some question. Some people said, oh, it's fine. And other people said, no, it's not. So
I think the state inspector said, here are the problems that you have.
You have
a month to clear them up.
Yeah.
And then the shelter inspector went out the next day and said, oh, no, and confiscated the dogs.
Yeah.
And the problem, I think, with any legal action was because the state inspector had given them a month to do something and the local people hadn't given them any time. The local state's attorney thought it would be very difficult to prosecute. That's from the legal end of it.
If you want to buy a puppy, it's best to go through a breeder who breeds only that breed or maybe one or two breeds. Stay away from people who are breeding multiple breeds, crossing breeds, making hybrid combinations, because those people are typically in it just for money. They're not looking to for the betterment of their breed. Temperament is, of course, one of the most important things when you're buying a puppy. Health and temperament, color, size, all those things don't make as much difference as the temperament of the dog and the health factors, especially their parents. Be sure to pick a breed that's correct for you. You don't get a border collie if you live in an apartment. You know, you have to think of what the dog was bred for. And so look for an appropriate dog for your lifestyle.
Is that the listener want to follow up?
I guess one other question. Is there any sort of the realty industry tries to talk about they got a code of ethics. Does the American Kennel Club or so forth or anybody have any sort of ethical code for dogs now?
Every national club has a code of ethics. They're all members of the American Kennel Club, and like our Alaska Malamute Club of America has a code of ethics. Every national club has a code of ethics, and one of the things that code of ethics says in every club that I've ever heard of is that you're not allowed to sell puppies in litter lots to pet stores. So when a pet store says that they're buying from breeders, they're not buying from breeders that are members of their national club and have signed on to that code of ethics.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize. Yeah. My other question is, would different breeds have different codes of ethics? And my reason for asking that is that my understanding is that some dogs, like Dobermans, my understanding was that they trim their ears and skin their ears and so forth to try and get them to stand up, and which in my way of thinking is, you know, if you can't breed it into them, that's probably not a good idea. And then I've had some experience with breeders of bulldogs and so forth, where they can't free whelp them, and so it's due to the somebody deciding they need to have big heads. And so it seems to me some of these things are to the detriment of the health of the breed, and that would seem to me ought to be unethical. That you ought to, health ought to be one of the primary things that you're trying to get, as opposed to, and if other things, you can do other things also and keep the health good, then I figure that, you know, that's probably okay. But like bulldogs in particular have a lot of breathing problems, and besides, partly because of the way their face is shaped and so forth. And anyway, that was my other question, whether different breeds sort of...
Yes, they do.
Their ethics a little to fit what they decide is what they want.
Yes. I think, like, in our code of ethics, it says you shouldn't breed a dog unless it's had certain health clearances that are specific to our breed. Most code of ethics talk about the health of the individuals that are being bred, that they have to pass health clearances or have a minimum of something like that. In some breeds, for instance, Dobermans, where the standard calls for the ears to be trimmed surgically, that's part of the breed standard. In Europe now, no docking, no ear cropping. They cannot surgically alter the dogs in any way in any breed, even tail docking. In the States, there's been a lot of talk with the American Kennel Club about not allowing trimming, ear trimming in boxers and Dobermans and Great Danes and so forth. And there's a movement amongst many breeders to try and breed more natural ears. And so I think that's an evolving process, as our veterinary schools do not teach vets how to trim ears because the vet schools do not approve of it. So I think it's a movement that's evolving, but it hasn't happened here yet that it's a rule. But you see more and more natural ears on some of the trimmed breeds now at shows.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Interesting question. I'm wondering on these on dogs that we're used to seeing docking and ear trimming, how did this begin? Do you know?
I think it's different in different breeds, but most of the breeds that require ear trimming, it was done because the ears flopping down were regarded as something that either another animal or a person could grab hold of and do something with. So they started trimming the ears to keep the ears from being something that could be focused on to grab the animal. Tail docking, there again, in some breeds, and especially in hunting breeds, I'm not sure why it started. It may have had something to do with the tail.
Getting burrs.
Yeah, well, in our case, getting burrs. But being a problem in the field in some way or another. So I'm not just sure exactly why some of the trimming started. But like in poodles, the cut that they use was specifically so that the dog could go be its water retriever. Poodles were bred, and people don't realize that, they were bred as a hunting dog to be a water retriever. But all that coat would bog them down, so they started trimming the coat so that places where the hair is covers the joints. So that was to keep the dog.
And the heart.
And the heart around the chest so that the dog was protected. But didn't have to carry all that heavy coat when they were in the water. So there are some reasons for some of the way these things were done. If you like a specific breed, go to the American Kennel Club website, and they have the breed standards accessible online and a little history of each breed. So you can start there and then just Google that breed, and you'll get to the National Club's website. And usually they have a nice page about the history of the breed, the evolution. One of the things that I think is a problem with purebred dogs is that you have a small genetic base to start with, and if you're only breeding that purebred to that purebred, then you slowly narrow your gene pool down, especially when you add health concerns mm-hmm. in there. So you weed out dogs that might have hip dysplasia or dogs that have eye problems. So as you weed out genetic problems, you narrow your base down further. And more AKC has become cognizant of the fact that some breeds are going to need an influx of new genes. So they're allowing, like the Basenjis, they allowed them to go to Africa and get new stock from Africa that were Basenjis, and they allowed them to interbreed them with the registered dogs here because Basenjis had some inherited, I think it was urinary tract problems. So AKC is getting more and more open to adding fresh genes to the gene pool. Yeah.
How often do breed standards change?
No.
That can be very controversial.
Yeah. Robin and I were involved in the last change.
Yeah.
And it's if I had my way, never, you know, but the Malamute standard was written in 1935. It was modified in 1960, and then it was modified again in 1995.
In 1993 or 1994, yeah. Something like that.
Robin was on the standard committee, and I was on the board of directors of the club. So the standard committee wrote it, and the board reviewed it, and that was a process.
And then the membership had to vote.
And then the membership had to vote on it. So it takes a long time. And in 1995, it wasn't that controversial. But back in the 1960s, when they modified it,
was it a big modification at that point?
Well, you wouldn't think so, but they raised the standard by 2 inches. So, and what, about 15 pounds?
It was a big controversy because the original dogs in our breed that were registered in 1935 were a specific line of dogs that were a certain size, and then they were decimated during World War II because they donated a lot of these dogs to the war effort, and instead of giving the dogs back at the end of the war to the people who donated them, they blew them up.
Actually, they sank them.
So, well, at the end of World War II, there were only a few registered Malamutes in the United States. So in order to keep the breed alive, they brought in some other dogs, which...
They did what we're talking about. They opened the stud book, as they say. They let unregistered dogs in that apparently were they looked like Malamutes, but they weren't registered. Their parents weren't registered.
Yeah, and they allowed them to compete, and if they got a certain number of points, then they were allowed to become officially registered. So
those dogs, however, actually came from Alaska, and whereas the other Malamutes probably came from Greenland, although they're called Alaskan Malamutes. And the Alaskan dogs were bigger than the Greenland dogs. So by 1960, the differences were pretty obvious. The people with the original dogs had much smaller dogs, and the people with the newer dogs had larger dogs. So the club said, well, let's change the standard to reflect the reality that the dogs are bigger. And therein lies the tale.
All heck broke loose, as the saying goes, but it was...
And,
Well, why was there ever any kind of suggestion that you have two standards, and that there be, you know, that they were sort of a grandfathered breed?
The people with the original dogs are called Kotzebues. The Kotzebue people wouldn't breed to the new dogs, absolutely. And then a lot of them wrote contracts that if you bought a dog from them, you couldn't breed to the other line, which were called the Malutes. So, I mean, that's how bitter it was.
Yeah. There were some lawsuits.
There were lawsuits.
It was a very tough time in our breed. And what happened in the end is the two lines were blended, and the best dogs turned out to be from the blended line, and the two original lines just sort of died out being pure on their own. There's still a few pure Kotzebues, but they have, for all intents and purposes, bred themselves into a corner. They just don't have anywhere to go genetically now. So it's a problem that after 50 years it sort of solved itself, but it caused a lot of problems.
Into the gene pool or not.
Yeah, so it was...
It was a lot like the Council of Trent.
Yeah. But in
a lot of bad feelings.
In some breeds, for instance, the Belgian Terviernes, the Belgian breeds, they did make new breeds out of them. So they had coat differences and color differences, and they just divided them up into different breeds. So they have Belgian Terviernes, Belgian Malinois, and Belgian Shepherds.
The Malinois, by the way, is the dog the Danville people are trying to get money to purchase for the city of Danville.
Yeah, most police forces now use Belgian Malinois instead of German Shepherds because they're slightly, they're a little more aggressive and they are healthier in terms of hips and so forth. But they're a little more aggressive too.
Over time, as nutrition has improved, I would imagine that dogs have gotten larger. Is that
That's one of the arguments within our breed. Well, the later Malamutes are bigger because they got better nutrition. And, you know, if they got the nutrition that the original dogs got, they wouldn't have gotten as big. So that it is an argument. Most standards have a size that they want the breed to be, and it's within a few inches or, in some cases, poundage. Like in dachshunds, miniature dachshunds have to be so many pounds, and certain classes, they actually weigh them at shows to make sure they're within that thing.
Mini dachshund in pounds? They look like ounces. They're so cute.
They have to be under 10 pounds or something like that. Yeah. So in some breeds, it's the amount of pounds versus the amount of inches. In border terriers, it's a requirement that they be spannable by a man's hand. So in the standard, it says they must be spannable. So the judge will take their hands and put them around their chest to make sure that they're, because that's how big they should be to able to get in rat holes and so forth to do their job.
Interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon are Jim Keel and Robin Haggard. They are husband and wife, and they have Malamutes, and they are also with the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is a topic we take up once a month on the first Friday of the month. We talk about dogs, dog care, behavior, and training. If you've got a question, join us this afternoon. Join our conversation. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you're listening in Champaign-Urbana, or in the surrounding area. The number to call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, tell us a little bit about, talk with us a little bit about how you determine a dog or a pup's temperament.
Well, we do a series of temperament tests on our puppies. At a certain age, 7 weeks, we put them through a certain number of tests, and it sort of helps to see what kind of personality the dog has. And
I think on the seventh week, because on the 49th day, their puppy's nervous system is completely hooked up. And so that's we try to do it right on the 49th day because it's early enough that they haven't learned behavior, but it's late enough that they actually have a functioning nervous system and can react to the various tests.
But we use it's a modified test from what the guide dogs for the blind developed, because back when they were first starting to breed dogs specifically for guide dogs, they found that a lot of their puppies were not passing. They would raise them and spend all that time getting them to a certain point, and then they weren't taking to the training the way they wanted, so they were washing out of the program.
One of the things the dogs had to do was listen to their master and ignore their master. So if the master said, let's cross the street, and a car was coming, the dog had to say no, sorry, we're not going to cross. And that's...
They had to learn to take responsibility.
Right. That's a lot of stress for a dog to obey somebody and not obey them. It's a concept where humans have a lot of trouble with.
So they developed some tests, which they found were very indicative of the dogs that would later be able to pass the training. And this was done in the late 50s, early 60s, and so we use kind of a variation of those tests. And one of the things that they found with the guide dog tests was if the puppy did not retrieve at 7 weeks, then that dog would never pass their program. So the retrieve tests seem to be extremely important in finding that the dog would be a trainable animal for their program. So Malamutes are not natural retrievers, so we don't expect ours.
So you know, they're like, scratch that test.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, some will, but and we I find the ones that do retrieve are the more biddable ones, the more the easier trained, more they want to please me more. With puppies, you want a friendly puppy, outgoing puppy, puppy that's not afraid, that's not shrinking back from the other, from people. It varies by breed, you know, different temperaments. In a guarding breed, you shouldn't expect the dog to be a guarding dog as a puppy. They develop those guarding instincts later in life, and so by 8 or 9 months, they'll be barking at strangers and things like that. But as a puppy, they should not do that sort of behavior. If they do, then it's indicative that they might have a shyness problem or a confidence problem. So You want a confident, outgoing, friendly dog.
We've been videotaping these tests for 20 years, more than that. So we've got all these tapes and now discs of the puppy tests. We have all this data, and we don't know what to do with it all.
Someday we'll sit down.
Someday.
Figure out how indicative it was. But it does help placing the puppies so you don't place a real dominant, tough puppy with people who are, you know, softer, not willing to discipline the dog as much. So you try and place the dog in the appropriate home. And that brings me to rescue. I was going to talk a little bit about adopting dogs through rescue, breed rescues, and through the shelter. When the dog's older, you can see what the temperament is formed better. And so a lot of the breed rescues will, when they get a dog back of their breed, they'll put them through a series of tests to make sure that they're good with kids or won't kill cats. And, you know,
shelters do the same kind of thing.
Shelters do also. So getting a dog from a shelter or a breed rescue is a very good place for people to look for a nice pet.
Okay. Should mention that is there a caller?
Yeah, there is.
Okay.
But go ahead and make a quick mention.
The temperament test at 49 days is a snapshot of the dog on that day. If you have a shy dog from the test, then you start working on its shyness. If you have an aggressive dog, you work on that. In other words, it's not anything that's set in stone, but it gives you an idea of what you have to do with this particular dog to make it a good pet.
Okay, let's take this call now. A listener in Danville on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. It certainly is pleasant being outside, and I have a question. I have a St. Bernard dog, 18 months old, is still wanting to jump on me. Any tips or pointers how I can reduce this behavior?
Jim's the expert on jumping up.
I always say, people say, Jim, how do you train your dog not to jump on you? And I always say, why would you want to do that? I train them to jump on me. Those are the two things you can do. Train the dog to jump on command and then never give him the command. And the other thing is to teach him to sit. And I assume you've probably been working on that.
Yeah, she sits on command, but when, like, they walk out to see her, then here comes the jump.
Well, you really want to then keep working on the sit. In other words, teaching a dog not to do something is very difficult, because they don't understand not. But if you teach a dog to sit when you approach it, reliably, then if the dog's sitting, it can't be jumping. So what you want to do is teach, instead of saying, don't jump on me, off, anything like that, teach the dog sit. Teach the dog something positive that is incompatible with the behavior you don't want, in this case, jumping.
Okay.
So work on that sit.
Okay. If she sits in on command, I reward her.
Reward the heck out of her, yeah.
Okay,
And don't be afraid, you know, put on some old clothes and have her jump up so you can teach her what off means. Usually the dog jumps up and you say off, and the dog has, you know, what does off mean to the dog, unless it's been trained that off means, you know, all 4 feet on the ground. Saying off isn't going to get the dog off.
Well, and if you as you approach, like if you're walking out the door and you see her coming running towards you, you can always show her a treat or a ball or something that she really likes, and as she's running towards you, just say sit. you know, and distract her with the treat or the toy. And that way she'll learn when she comes to you it's a good thing, but make sure you lavishly then greet her in the sit position, because what they're doing is they want to greet you.
Yeah.
And they want to get as close to your face as they can, so that's one reason why they jump up. But if you distract her a little with the treat or the toy, tell her sit, and then reward her, she'll learn that when she runs up to you, if she sits, she's going to get something really good.
Okay, great. That's a great idea. Thanks so much.
Sure.
You're very welcome. Also on the command to come, that reward is really important. And if you want the animal to come to you, and this is true even of my cats, you know, if you've got something good, call their name with the right tone of voice.
And there's two rules that I give my puppy class on the recall. And one is you never, ever, ever punish your dog if you call it and it comes. You have to praise. If you're going to punish your dog, you have to go to it. And the other thing is don't teach him to disobey the come command. Only use the come command when you can enforce and when you've got a leash on him or their dog food bowl in your hand. Those are the two times.
And what I tell my class is a third thing, and that is if the dog comes to you on its own, don't ignore it.
Yeah.
By ignoring it, you are inadvertently training the dog not to come to you. I came to you, nothing happened, so it's not really worth coming to you. So a lot of people will unconsciously train their dogs not to come to them by ignoring them.
Yeah.
And in other words, it's not an active punishment or anything like that. It's just negligence.
It's like how we'd like to be treated.
Exactly.
Right?
You go up to somebody and say hi, and they look the other way. You know, you're not going to say hi to them anymore.
So. Other questions about dogs are invited this afternoon. We've got about 8 minutes left in this portion of the program. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, a quiet month, October, for the Dog Training Club?
We just finished an agility trial about 2 weeks ago, and we have a obedience trial coming up in November and a tracking test
in December. And we have a seminar in early November.
Agility seminar.
Yeah, but public events, not many. We've got the classes going. And
when's the next round of classes?
It'll be the second week of January.
Yeah, we're just starting a session now that just is about 2 weeks old. There's a big round of dog shows coming up in Springfield the weekend of the 17th, 18th, 19th in there at the fairgrounds in Springfield. And there's 4 days of all breed dog shows, and I think there might be obedience trials at a couple of them. But if people are interested in seeing different breeds, those are free admission, and you can just go and watch the dogs and meet breeders and see what breeder's for you.
I don't think they have elephant ears, though, or anything.
No, but they have great ribs.
They have great ribs. Somebody comes from Michigan, usually, and has a concession, and it's wonderful.
Good food over there at the dog shows.
Okay. Yeah. Let's take another call, a listener in Savoy. Line one, hi.
Hi. I'd like to know what you do with a dog who sticks his nice pointed nose in everybody's crotch. How do you cure that dog?
Cure it? Is it a problem? the dog has somehow learned to do this. It's something all dogs do, and it's a way that they come, you know, they get to know you. And it's obviously for humans, it's not all that pleasant or it's very awkward. But it's the same thing as with the dog jumping, and that is teach the dog something incompatible with that. And that usually is the sit, because the sit is the easiest thing to teach a dog, really.
Well, the dog is very obedient in every other way, so it's just a matter of telling her to sit then.
Right. And the point is when the dog is coming up and sniffing you and you start saying no, no, no and walking away, the dog it's not really clear to the dog what it's doing that's so offensive, because it's not offensive to the dog.
Oh.
So it thinks, well, you have some sort of problem, but I'll ignore that and keep sniffing. And so telling a dog no, eventually it might figure it out if it eliminated all the variables when you said no. But usually it's just better to teach the dog a sit. And what I'll mention to you, and I should have mentioned to the other gentleman, try throwing in a hand signal as you say sit, just as a little extra for the dog. Because the hand signal is usually, and by hand signal I mean just hold your palm up and just raise your hand as a signal to the dog to sit. Because I'm assuming when the dog comes up and starts sniffing you, you're going, no, no, stop, no.
Yeah,
you know,
everybody does.
Yeah, exactly. And in the thing about a hand signal, it's neutral. You know, you're not yelling at the dog. That voice to the dog might sound very friendly and appealing, you know, because if you eliminate the words, and, you know, if you said that to a puppy, they'd start wagging their tail and approach you. So usually alarm signals from humans are signals for a dog to approach. And if you have a nice hand signal and you don't have to say anything, then you're actually not rewarding the dog for doing it. I think there's, you know, as I said earlier, there's a lot of inadvertent training that goes on. And this, the crotch sniffing is one of them.
Usually the dogs do it in greeting, too. It's when a person first comes to your home.
Yes, that's true.
And so we had a female years ago that she was invariably, she would do this. So we just learned to take her by the collar, and when she'd meet new people, we'd just make her sit until they had greeted her. And then that avoided that issue. But I'd make her sit, and I'd actually have her on her collar and have the people put their hands out and pet her for a minute. And then usually that eliminated her need to sniff.
Okay.
But it does take some preparation on your part so that when people come to the door or if they're getting out of their car and the dog rushes to greet them, that you're going to get control of the dog right away.
It's especially true of kids because they tend to have a very high-pitched voice, which is very pleasant to the dog. Mm-hmm. So the dog comes in and starts sniffing. They go, ah! And the dog goes, oh, thank you. I agree. This is a pleasant thing.
Yeah,
So you really have to watch with kids and do what Robin said and do a little extra holding and saying, because a lot of kids are afraid of dogs or things like that. So especially with kids, you want to do that.
Well, that's very helpful. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Well, here to wrap up, any thoughts on introducing a dog to a child and a child to a dog? How do you handle that?
It depends on the size of the dog. But,
and the age of the kid.
Yeah. But with little, for rule number one is you never leave any dog alone with a baby or a toddler.
Never, ever.
Yeah. No matter how good-tempered that dog is, you never leave them alone together. It's always got to be supervised. And if you have a large breed like ours, then you want the dog to be relatively quiet, have it sitting or in a down position so that the child can come up and reach their hand out, teach the child to reach their hand out, let the dog sniff their hand, and then pet them. I don't usually like to give the child treats if they're a little child because some dogs get grabby with treats.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to use something, I would tend to use like a soft toy or they call them Buddha bones, those rope toys, something that's big enough so that the child's hand isn't going to get in the way. They can offer the dog something like that. And just have it be a very calm greeting. And once the dog is calmly been petted by the child and the child is feeling more confident, then you can even take the dog for a walk and let the child maybe hold the leash with you, things like that. Children get very confident when they get empowered by having that end of that leash on that dog. They get a lot of confidence from that. So children that are afraid of dogs, I encourage to take a nice calm dog for a walk, because then the child feels like they're in control.
My pet peeve
is
people that get dogs so they can teach their children responsibility, and they say, here's the dog, be responsible. You wouldn't teach a kid how to cook by saying, here's the stove, don't burn yourself, and see you later.
Yeah.
So if you get an animal and you want your child to learn how to take care of it, you have to supervise it. Just because you give it to the kid doesn't mean he's learned responsibility, depending on their age, of course. But and we've had experience with people, well, I got this dog to teach my kid responsibility, and it turned out he wasn't responsible. Well, the kid's eight. Come on, you know. And you're an adult. You're supposed to be guiding the kid, not throwing an untrained animal and an untrained kid together and saying, see you later. That's my okay. Soapbox for the day.
And on that, we'll wrap it up. Good to see you, Robin. Thanks for coming in this afternoon. Jim, good to see you as well, as usual, and we'll see you next month.
November 7th.
November 7th,
the latest
okay.
we can be here on the first Friday.
First Friday of November. We will talk once again about dogs, and our guests this afternoon, Jim Keel and Robin Haggard, are with the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana.